Session number 25574, Reel 2.
I'm interested that you talk of this sort of idea of fatalism, being a 17, 18-year-old young man heading off to fight for king and country, being prepared to die for king and country. What was the idea that you would be asked to kill for king and country?
Had to be done.
But you've presumably never been in a situation of killing anyone before.
No.
Did you ever think about how you might cope with that scenario?
No. I don't think so. We were taught to fire 303 rifles. We'd go down to the range and fire at targets which were in the form of men. Went to bayonet charges. We were conditioned for it. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm interested, people talk, to what degree was there a quest for adventure involved in your desire to go away?
Well, there was an element of adventure in it, of course. But that's all I'd say, an element of adventure. And of course, I repeat, I wasn't alone. No one was alone. We had mates. We were all in uniform. And you had the camaraderie, whatever the correct pronunciation is, of like souls.
What does it feel like to be in a proper soldier's uniform now?
Then? I think I was quite proud to be a soldier.
How did people look at you in relation to it?
With respect, I think I've said that before. I don't know that the same thing applies now, and we're not talking about now. But yes, there was great respect. Well, we used to laugh, of course, about the Blue Orchid, so were the Air Force, and so on.
I'm interested in that. You obviously had the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. In what order did they come in relation to how they were seen by young blokes, do you think?
Well, the glamour one was the Air Force, and I suppose rightly so, too.
Why?
Oh, they had lovely uniforms, but that wasn't the real reason. Oh, there was a certain amount of glamour with the fighter pilots. They were always written up in the paper. There were the aces. Oh, just forget their name. It doesn't matter.
I'm interested in that. Okay, you had the Flyboys, the Blue Walkers, the sort of Biggles Brigade, all of that sort of business. Mm. How was the Navy seen?
Oh, the girls loved the sailors.
Did they? Why?
I don't. I don't know. I wasn't a girl, so I can't answer that. I don't know. But there was they loved the sailors with their bell-bottom trousers and their white cap and so on. And when the ships came into port, the girls were there in their hundreds, thousands almost, to greet the fellows. Yeah, they loved the sailors.
Mm. I'm interested, some people that I've interviewed have said that their fathers warned them against joining the infantry. Don't be a mug. Don't be one of the ground force. Don't be one of the frontline chaps.
Yes, that's right. They were called the Poor Bloody Infantry, the PBI. And it didn't happen because I've already said I was with this Army Service Corps, which happened because the fellow who really recruited me was in the ASC. But my father didn't have to encourage or discourage me about joining the infantry. But later on in the war, I had a rule where an elder brother could claim a younger brother, and my father got on to me because my younger brother was in the an infantry battalion.
Sorry, you were going to continue. Your brother was in an infantry battalion, you were claiming him.
Yes, and he joined the ASC. Whether that was right or wrong, with hindsight, I don't know. Because he was a private, and I actually was a staff sergeant, and there was quite a fair a gap, I suppose, in our relationships. I don't mean as a brother, but in relation, the hierarchy.
In relation to the enemy, the Germans at this stage, and the Italians, the situation that occurred in May of 1940, Dunkirk, how did that strike home? The Germans had come through with absolute ease. They had Panzer tanks, they were blitzing the West. What was the thought? To what degree did it look to you that the war might actually be over? And Britain and you might be on the losing side.
Oh, I suppose I just had to believe what Churchill said. We will fight them on the beaches. We will fight them in the streets. We will fight them in the cities. We will fight them in the villages. We will never surrender.
How is he saying?
Oh, the old fighting bulldog. Oh, yes. He was seen as, the fighting bulldog. I think that's the way I saw him and how most people saw him. I believe he had an aside when he said that famous speech, and he turned to someone and said, I don't know what we're going to fight them with.
Is that something that you felt, though? I mean, given your training, when had you seen any tanks in Australia?
Oh, yes, we had tanks.
One's equivalent to Panzer tanks, though?
Ours were fairly old lumbering tanks.
People talk of the equipment being out of date. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
In what way was it?
Well, the first rifle I had would have been made in about 1910. We needed trucks, and so they just requisitioned trucks from firms. Just took them, and we needed cars, so they just requisitioned cars. Things improved later. For example, I used to make lovely rifles out of Lithgow, and much later on, I'm talking the Japanese War. There was the Bren gun that was made over in Europe, and the anti-tank rifles we used were made over in Europe, but we made here, what were they called? The Sten, Owen gun and the Sten gun, that's right. They were made here in, by their thousands, and they were a far better weapon. But the 303s were more or less useless in the jungle. Actually, I'm digressing. I'm getting
That's
off
okay.
the subject. Mm. And I gave you the example of the... Oh, we had Owen... No, wrong. Lewis guns, how they ever fired, I do not know. They were worn out. They were left over from the First World War. Yes, we were highly under-equipped, and my late wife, still laughs. She must have been down at Balcombe Camp, and she saw us practicing getting in and out of trucks. We were getting in and out of trucks. We were getting in and out of chairs. We just had next to nothing.
Mm. So these chairs would be set up in rows, like you were getting into a truck.
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds a bit like Dad's army to me.
Well, in some respects, initially it was, because we had next to nothing. The cook had old Sawyer stoves. Do you know what a Sawyer stove is? You know your mother's... No, you wouldn't. An old wash copper. A cast iron.
I've heard of a copper, yeah.
Stand on, with a big copper in it, and a fire underneath it, and the cook would make stew in that, and soup, and so on, and they were left over from the First World War. Oh, goodness.
Mm. What was it like being a soldier? Did you enjoy being a soldier?
Oh, I think I'd have to say yes. Yeah. Yes, I...
What sort of things you'd get up to early on in the piece in relation to the training, in relation to mucking in with your mates?
I don't know. What were you driving at?
In relation to being a soldier early on, tell us about daily life. Tell us about the sorts of things you'd get up to, the sorts of situations you'd find yourselves in camp.
Oh, well, that's a bit hard to answer because they say never volunteer for a job. And I can vividly remember, I must have been a corporal at the time, and we were at the drill hall in South Melbourne, and Jack Lacey, who was the RSM, said, "I'm calling for a volunteer who would join the quartermaster store as a quartermaster." And I thought to myself, well, I volunteer, or, you know, the first rule is never volunteer. I said, oh, to hell with that, I'm going to have a bash at that. And so I became a quartermaster sergeant. And to some extent from there on, well, I was in the sergeant's mess to start with, which, of course, gave a bit of prestige. We had our own cook, and we ate as sergeants, and the sergeant majors and so on. We had our own bar. And I actually remained a staff sergeant until the end of the war. So I was somewhat, from that time on, removed from the rank and file, if you understand. I had a job to do, and the job we did, and I would have had a couple of offsiders from time to time, but it was very interesting. We'd have to look forward now, what are the requirements going to be, how many boots are we going to need, how many uniform jackets, and they brought in, I think it was conscription, but it was called something service, and these fellows were called up, and so we had to be ready for them with boots and socks and shirts and singlets and you name it, food and goodness knows what.
We had compulsory service.
Ah, that's the word, yes. I couldn't think of the word.
I'm interested, at this time early on, obviously the Japanese hadn't entered the war, what were you hearing about the Japanese and their movements? Prior to Pearl Harbor, what had you known about the Japanese, do you think?
Not a great deal. And the complete focus was on the war in Europe. At that time, I wasn't in the intelligence service, so I think I was fairly remote from it. I just had a job to do, and it was a full-time job, and I did it. And if we hadn't done it, you'd get a kick in the behind. If you hadn't, if you didn't have the boots, as I said, and the uniforms and whatever was necessary.
What sort of news were you hearing in relation to how the war was going following the period of Dunkirk? May, June, and July of 40. Do you recall things like the Battle of Britain?
Oh, yes.
How was that seen?
It was the... What did Churchill say? Never has so much been owed by so many to so few. And that about sums it up. And
the French had signed an armistice with the Germans. How was that? How was that seen? That was June 22nd of 40.
Oh, typical of the French. That's how that was seen.
Of course, there was the Free French, but there was the Vichy French, and we had later on people in the Middle East fighting the Vichy French in Syria. What do you recall of the Middle East campaign? The early experiences of the Middle East campaign. What have you heard about them? January of 41, the 6th Division attacks forces at Bardia. Tobruk falls to the Australian troops. Thousands, 25,000 Italian prisoners were being taken. There seemed to be quite a bit of success in the Middle East.
There was quite a lot of success there, and there were photographs in the paper of these Italians with their hands up and so on, and they just laid down their weapons. Yep, I can remember that. I was not there, but I can remember that being very widely publicised in the press. And I think they had another thing called the Benghazi Derby, where they raced along. And Montgomery was in charge then, wasn't he?
No, the people talk of the Benghazi Handicap and the Benghazi Derby and all that, all those sorts of things. When Rommel came in, people were going backwards and forwards along the north coast of North Africa.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the situation. How was the war seen to be going at that point?
I don't know. Sorry.
That's right. When Germany went off to Russia in June of 41, how was that seen? Do you recall that as a standing out point in the war?
They went and they... did the Napoleon, didn't they? I went at the wrong time. But that's all. I'm
They've been having some pretty major successes up until that point. Germany invaded Crete from the air.
Yep.
Greece and Crete had taken place.
Yep.
Things were looking pretty good for the Germans up until that time, and they continued to look pretty good for the Germans for a while after that. People talk, as you mentioned, of that German Barbarossa campaign as a turning point. Was that something at that time that people felt, do you think?
I don't know.
December 41.
7th of December?
Tell us about what you recall of that experience.
Well, I think it's fairly common knowledge that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
How was that seen?
Sank the fleet. the US fleet.
How was that seen at the time?
Total disaster.
How then were the Japanese seen in the way that they'd entered the war, do you think?
It was looked upon as being a bit sneaky, I suppose, but the animosity towards the Japanese hadn't started at that stage.
Sorry, you wanted to continue?
I think what I'd said was that they were regarded as sneaky, but yes, the animosity wasn't there. That came much later.
Okay, well let's talk about how the Japanese were seen at this time, as you can recall. They'd come in, they'd bombed Pearl Harbor. Only 3 days later, the Prince of Wales and the Repulse had been sunk off Malaya by a Japanese aircraft, and they were pretty major ships.
How were the Japanese?
How were they seen as a fighting force? How were they portrayed?
In the minds of people like myself, well, they were looked to be invincible, didn't they? Because they marched through, was it down the Malaysia, Siam, and over the causeway, riding their bicycles, and turned the water off, but did all these clever things. Yeah, I turned the water off for Singapore, I mean.
How was the fall of Singapore seen, February the 15th, 42?
A total disaster. Total disaster.
Had you heard, or were you to hear, about the bombing of Darwin, Broome?
I certainly didn't know about the bombing of Broome. I certainly didn't.
19th of February, first Japanese air attack on Darwin, 1942.
We didn't know a lot about it because it was all censored.
People were to talk of invasion by the Japanese. Was that something that people genuinely felt?
Not at that stage. The talk of Japanese invasion was after they'd moved down through the Dutch East Indies and they were already in New Guinea. That's when people really started to think about the Japanese invading Australia. And, because fortunately the Coral Sea Battle took place.
Well, we can talk about that.
That's another.
MacArthur was to arrive.
Yes, I shall return.
In March. How is MacArthur? General MacArthur arrives in Australia on the 17th of March. How is he seen at that time?
Well, he was viewed with mixed feelings.
Why?
As to whether he had deserted his troops and hightailed it to Australia. There was a feeling that he might have done that, deserted the troops. But then, on the other hand, we were very relieved to see the G.I. Joes in Australia and the American sailors and Catalinas, they were over here, of course.
Overpaid, oversexed, and over here.
Mm.
Was that true?
Well, they were overpaid compared to us. And they had beautiful uniforms. They were entirely tailored. There was a certain degree of animosity underlying it all, that these bloody Yanks were here and with their big cigars and Coca-Cola and goodness knows what. Oversexed, overpaid and over here. Someone said that. Probably a bit unkindly, but that's how a lot of people saw the Americans.
A lot of young Australian blokes, I understand, felt pretty darkly on the Americans because they didn't have as good a chance to show off to the women.
Well, our fellows were up in the front line in New Guinea and wherever, and the Yanks were down here.
All right.
And of course, a lot of the girls fell for the Yanks because of the glamour of the uniform, and the Yanks could take them to places that our fellows couldn't afford. I can't tell you how much pay I received, but it wasn't very much.
People talk of five Bob a day murderers. Did you ever experience any sort of animosity in that respect?
No, never. No, I've never heard the statement.
In relation, were there people that were against the war? Do you recall?
We're talking Japanese.
We're talking about the Second World War in general. Do you recall anyone being against the war?
Yes, there was a small... was this a small group of anti-anything?
How were they seen?
With disdain by the troops and by anybody with a brain in their head. They weren't highly regarded at all. Mm. Oh, there were anti-conscription groups, there were anti-this and anti-the-other, but in those days, my recollection is that they weren't as highly organised, like you get these splinter groups now, and they managed to get a great deal of publicity, a lot of it unwarranted. I shouldn't say unwarranted, but unjustified publicity. Mm. But not in those days, they weren't organised.
Churchill about Singapore was to have said, the greatest disaster in our history, a grievous and shameful blow to the British prestige. The fact that Singapore had gone, the fact that the Japanese were having such success and they were sort of on their way, how did that make people in Australia feel?
Not particularly happy, thank you very much. Because it was one disaster after another. And Singapore was invincible. That was the impression that people had been given to understand. So it was a great disaster, a great blow. Mm. The guns were pointed in the wrong way, weren't they?
They had the wrong ammunition as well, I understand. Armour-piercing warhead. In relation to the Japanese, what sort of precautions were people starting to take about the fact that they might actually someday soon?
Slit trenches were being built. A lot of people had them in their backyard. Other people built concrete shelters. There were slit trenches around it, in parks in the cities. Windows were taped. Yes, precautions were being taken, very, very serious ones. Oh, and we had air raid wardens and... well, let me think, what else?
Well, had you ever heard of the Brisbane Line?
Well, of course I know it now, and I was on both ends of it. But I suppose I had thought about it. It was the Brisbane Line. We were going to let the Japanese come into Australia and stop them at the Brisbane Line.
And they could have the rest. People on the northern side of the Brisbane Line were basically going to have to fend for themselves.
That's what the philosophy of the higher up of the chiefs of general staff was, yes. Mm. Rather...
How are people like Blamey seen, Commander-in-Chief by March?
Tom? Tom was never very highly regarded.
Why not?
And yet at the Naval and Military Club in Melbourne there's a painting of, it's a beautiful painting of Tom Blamey. It's ought to be the size of that wall there, that on the entrance as you go in, because he was, I think he was our first general.
Why was he seen in such poor light though?
Oh, he was accused of being a womaniser. And I forget his wife's name. She got a, and I think I'm right when I say this, she got a post with the Red Cross, and she was posted near Tom so she could keep an eye on him.